Your reasons for listening to this show, well, those are your own. But just keep in mind that the views, information, or opinions expressed on the Tuttle Daily Podcast are solely those of the individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of our sponsors. Yeah, it's called free speech, people. Nobody's forcing you to listen.
Get ready for your daily dose of Tuttle.
The all-time greatest intern slash producer we've ever had, of course, Tuttle. Tuttle in Florida.
From the Hobo Fish Camp, it's the Tuttle Daily Podcast.
No wonder nobody likes you, Tuttle. Everything's a goddamn debate.
Greetings and welcome to another edition of the Tuttle Daily Podcast. Hopefully you guys are enjoying your day so far. A couple of ways you can get a hold of me. I've been getting a lot of feedback, a lot of interaction with the listeners, especially over the drug text that my mom has been getting. You can email me tuttle@gmail.com. That's Tuttle with two D's, tuddle@gmail.com. Or you can leave me a voicemail, 407-270-3044. I want to thank everybody that tuned in to the Tuttle Daily Podcast live stream last night. My producer, Vulture, ended up bringing a whole bunch of, like, dress clothes, nice clothes that I guess he wasn't wearing anymore. I don't know if maybe he's put on some weight and it didn't fit anymore. And he wanted to give me his skinny clothes because they're fitting me perfectly. I mean, they fit like a glove. And last night, I wore one of the dress shirts. I had a bunch of meetings and stuff yesterday. And I rushed right in and I just brought the collar down, kind of popped it, had the tie around my neck, kind of hanging there loosely. And a lot of people gave me, because I did, I took a couple of selfies after the podcast, the live stream last night, because a lot of people were like, oh man, you look great. This is a great look. Your hair looks awesome. And I was, okay, I'm going to take a selfie. I always feel like the biggest douchebag when I take selfies, but I ended up taking a selfie. I posted it and I got a lot of great compliments. Matter of fact, most of the times when I do post pics, I get trolls. I do. And even though that I go on and I do this podcast and I've been on the radio the past 22 years, I still am not a very confident person. Like, I have a lot of self-doubt. I got a lot of low self-esteem. It does. Like, I'm not good at taking compliments. And it has a lot to do with the childhood trauma that I went through as a kid. Well, it wasn't because my mom and dad. I know that you guys probably get tired of me talking about this without giving you the Iggy and all the info. It's just, I'm not ready to talk about it. I really am getting to the point where I'm starting to lean that I'm going to talk about it. But it has. It really has messed me up in my adult life with relationships. It's really messed up my life. Being able to take compliments. I always have self-doubt. So, yeah. That's my issues. And I'm always so awkward. Like, I feel like when I meet new people, they're always judging me. Because the thing is that they hear what they hear on the air or what I've done on social media. And they take that as like, oh, man, this guy's a real scumbag. He worked for such and such. And he worked for this other guy, such and such. And they've all had scandals. And that does happen. It does. My whole entire life is just out there for anybody to see or listen to. And I think that's another reason why I always think, those people can't possibly think that about me. I mean, I got some close friends, not a lot of them, but those are the ones that I trust. It's just, I have a hard time. And this pandemic really, really has killed that as well, too. I talk to my friend Amy all the time, talk to Colton, I talk to Richie, I talk to Vulture, you know, it's just, I don't know. I know that I'm probably sounding like a real bitch by bringing that up. I just thought it was kind of cool. So I'm just, thank you, everybody that gave great compliments. You guys are extremely, extremely nice. I'm sorry if I seem a little awkward when I reply. I try to reply back to everybody that said nice things. So thank you. See, I even have a hard time taking compliments and saying thank you for them. So that's just me. I want to get into my first news story of the day. Yesterday, or last night, they had the ballots, all the people that were going to get into the Major League Baseball Hall of Fame, and David Ortiz made it. And I think that's a great choice. It's a great choice for David Ortiz to be there. He's a great personality. He helped the Boston Red Sox win their first World Series in like 98 years or 80 years. I know it was a really, really long time. But David Ortiz, right after the Boston bombing, he got up in front of the Red Sox fans at Fenway Park, and he gave the speech. He was like, you know what? This is fucking Boston. And the crowd went crazy. He was like, we're not Red Sox. What's on the front of our jersey says Boston, and nobody fucks with Boston. And I think that got him a lot of bump when it came to that, because that's what they want. They want the total package when it comes to electing people into the Baseball Hall of Fame. It used to be about what you did on the field, but it isn't anymore. You got to have a great personality, and David Ortiz had that. I think David Ortiz spent his entire career with the Boston Red Sox. And I also think that's another thing that does help a lot of players out, that they stay with the same team all their whole entire career. Look at Chipper. Chipper Jones, first ballot Hall of Famer, made it in, was with the Braves the whole entire time. He restructured a lot of his deals just so he could stick around, so he didn't get traded. And I really do think that helped Chipper Jones out. Now, I'm going to get into my feelings on some of the people that aren't in the Hall of Fame. Like, for example, Bonds, Clemens, Sosa. They weren't even talking about McGuire. I think McGuire kind of just was like, you know what? I'm withdrawing my hat from this. Because everybody, I see what's happening to everybody else. But Bonds, McGuire, Sosa, Roger Clemens. I think this was the last year that they were eligible to make it into the Hall of Fame. And I think there's going to be some things that need to be done. And I'll get into that. Oh, and the same thing goes with Pete Rose. I think Pete Rose should have been in a long time ago. Yeah, he did bet on baseball, but it was proven that he never bet against the team that he was coaching or playing for. I don't see a problem with that, because if you're betting on yourself to win, that means you have all the motivation to be able to make it and play the best that you can and help your team win, because you're betting on yourself.
Yes!
Big Poppy has reason to celebrate this morning. Red Sox slugger David Ortiz, now a first ballot Hall of Famer, selected in his first year of eligibility and is now the youngest current Hall of Famer.
It's a wonderful honor to be able to get in. My first rodeo is something that is very special to me.
Known as Big Poppy, he rallied the city and won hearts in the wake of the Boston Marathon bombings, leading the Red Sox that year to a World Series title, their third.
David Ortiz got in because he was a great player and a big personality, and that is a winning combination in Hall of Fame voting.
See, I kind of get that. I get that. You know, a lot of people always, you know, these pundits on TV, they'll tell LeBron James, just shut up and dribble the ball, or we don't want to hear your opinion. We don't need to know your personality. Just shoot up and shut up and dribble the ball, or shut up and run the ball, or catch the ball, or hit the ball. We don't need to hear your opinions on stuff. And David Ortiz was that type of person. And as the game has evolved, it is true. Like, you do have to have a larger-than-life personality, a likable personality, to be able to make it, especially with all the social media and stuff out there. It's just 24/7. You got to be on your game And David Ortiz was that player.
And Bonds, 756.
But baseball's home run king has been shut out and possibly for good. Barry Bonds not elected to the Hall of Fame.
All right, so I'm going to touch on this, okay? I don't care how many steroids Barry Bonds took in his life. Now, the steroids does help you recover from injuries. It keeps you healthier and stronger, and that is an advantage. It definitely is. But think about this. Barry Bonds is the only player in Major League history to hit 500 home runs and steal 500 home runs. On that stat alone, I mean, it's also the same thing of saying Pete Rose, the only player in baseball history to get 4,000 hits. How do you keep him out of that? And let's bring up the fact that they had the strike in the mid-90s, which really, really hurt baseball. It did. Baseball almost had that final nail in its coffin. People were pissed off. They were angry. And I got to say, baseball was complicit with the steroid era. They turned their heads. They weren't doing all the testing that they could. Matter of fact, I wouldn't even be shocked if we found out one day that baseball was like, Bonds, take these steroids. McGuire, take these steroids. Sosa, take these steroids. Clemens, take these roids. Because they needed to do something. And I'm a little bit different. I was a pitcher. I would rather watch a great pitching performance. Like, I think Kerry Wood's 20 strikeouts, it might have been 21, I can't remember, against the Houston Astros at Wrigley Field was one of the greatest things that I ever saw. And I'll give you another example. Greg Maddux never threw a no-hitter in his whole entire career, but guess what? One of the most impressive pitching performances I ever saw, a 73-pitch shutout game. He ended up pitching 73 pitches in 9 innings, complete game. That's really impressive. But if I'm being honest, the reason people go to Major League Baseball games is for the long ball. Chicks dig the long ball. Just like in that commercial with Glavine and Maddux where they were like, oh man, nobody likes us. We're just pitchers. We go out there and we do this. And they wanted to get stronger. They trained to be able to hit home runs. And at the end, they say chicks love the long ball. And that's the truth. The home run battle between McGuire and Sosa saved baseball. It did. Their viewerships were up. Hell, I remember that summer, they would break into national TV news or any of these other programs. Like, they would show Mark McGuire's at-bat getting close to tying Roger Maris's home run record, and then they would show them all because they wanted to get that home run archived and be able to see it. Everybody wanted to be a part of it. And then him, Sosa, McGuire being so close to each other. I mean, McGuire did pull away at the end. Baseball loved it. Baseball knew what was going on. And for all the people that want to say that Bonds did not take steroids, come on, man. The dude's head swelled up. The guy, look at him when he played at Pittsburgh. He was a completely different person when he played in Pittsburgh. Then when he went to San Francisco, the guy just blew up. The guy had the biggest forearms, the biggest, like, everything was big on Barry Bonds. I don't know about the little tinky-winky between the legs, because they always say that, you know, that kind of shriveled things up. Maybe it's just a testicle. I don't know. It also helped that Barry Bonds played in a hitter or home run hitter friendly park out there hitting it into the bay. He did that a lot. But Barry Bonds is still good. Overall, Barry Bonds might be one of the greatest. He played great defense. Think about this. Barry Bonds was hitting so many home runs, they would walk Barry Bonds with the bases loaded. So, yes, he definitely deserves to be in the Hall of Fame. I don't know about McGuire. I don't know about Sosa. Definitely P. Rose. Maybe even McGuire. I don't know. Because like I said, baseball knew what was going on. Now baseball is basically turned their backs on him. And it's like, no. No entry for you, my friend.
He was plagued by steroid scandals during his career, and he's now not alone. One of four baseball legends to fall short on their final shot at sport's highest honor, including Roger Clemens, who amassed more than 350 career wins and a record 7 Cy Young Awards. But he also couldn't outrun accusations that he used performance-enhancing drugs, allegations both he and Bonds have repeatedly denied.
Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens, incredible players, all-time great players, not great personalities, and the fact that they were tied to performance-enhancing drugs like they were ultimately wrote them a ticket off of the ballot for the 10th time.
All right, I'll bring this, okay? You can get the biggest muscled up men in your life roided out of their heads. Like, they're beating up their girlfriends, walking pit bulls around on chains. Yeah, those type of people. And if you put a bat in their hand and tell them to hit a 90 to 95 mile an hour fastball, a breaking ball, the nastiest changeups you'll ever see, they would never be able to do that. Because guess what? Steroids does not help you hit the ball. Steroids does not help you catch the ball. Baseball is a very, very skilled thing to do. That's why if you bat over 300 in a lifetime and get like 2,000 hits and about 300 or 400 home runs, guess what? You're going to Cooperstown as long as you didn't cheat. I really do not understand this. And baseball, like I said, they had a lot to do with this, and now they're covering it up, and they're trying to make good that, hey, we didn't know about this, so we're not going to let these people in, and it's just not fair. You know what? Clemens, I always thought Clemens was a dick. I really don't care if he ever gets in.
Clemens reacted to the announcement, writing, I put the Hall of Fame in the rearview mirror 10 years ago. I didn't play baseball to get into the Hall of Fame. For years, Hall of Fame voters have taken a hard line against players with tainted legacies from the sport's so-called steroids era.
All right. This is also another thing that needs to be changed. You got enough people that are in the Hall of Fame that are still alive. I think it should be like the Heisman. I think that news people do get to vote on that, but as far as I know, I think that former past winners or past winners get to actually vote on it. So now that you got all these players, well, I mean, that number's kind of dwindling because there's been years that they haven't inducted anybody in. But I think it would be cool to let the people that are actually in the Hall of Fame get to vote on it. I think that they definitely should get a say in it. If you're in the Hall of Fame, you should be able to say, you know what, Barry should be able to be in. You should be able to get voted in by a court or a jury of your peers instead of these nerdy-ass sports reporters that couldn't make it playing baseball, couldn't make it past high school baseball, and they're getting to vote on who gets in there? Nah, it's bullcrap. There are some writers, I don't care if it was Babe Ruth himself, the second coming of Babe Ruth, had held all the records, didn't do anything wrong, no scandals at all. There are some writers that just refuse to vote to put somebody in on the first ballot just because they want to be dicks.
But with some of the most impressive records in history now facing permanent exile, some are lamenting on-field accomplishments being overshadowed by off-field scandals.
Got another great interview lined up from my producer, Vulture. Now, Brian, hopefully you're not going to be mad at me because I do like to try to get people's last names right sometime. And sometimes sure. I butcher them, okay? So please don't get offended if I butcher your last name. Then you can correct me, okay?
Sounds like a plan.
All right, Brian. It is Brian Asingia, is it? Or Asingia?
Asingia like ninja. You got it.
Asingia.
Yeah.
All right. Hey, Brian, how are you? How are you today, my friend?
I'm doing really well, thank you.
Brian, where are you calling from right now?
Calling from New York City.
It's got to be cold up there, isn't it?
Yeah, it's supposed to snow this weekend, so we'll see.
It's going to even get worse this weekend. Brian, before we get into the interview, tell my audience, my supporters, listeners, a little bit about yourself and a little bit about what you do.
Sure. Well, Brian Asinja, and I would like to say I'm an author, advisor, and investor. And primarily what I do on a day-to-day is management consulting, which is advising other companies either optimize their revenue, but also get investment or funding. I'm a electrical computer engineer by training, used to work at the New York Stock Exchange, and I just finished writing my second book. So people can also find me online at www.brianasinja.com. That's BRIANASINGIA.com. And the social media handles are the same at Brian Asinja.
All right. So Brian, so say I'm just regular Joe Schmo. I'm your 9-to-5 pail bucket Johnny that just goes to work, does his time, comes home. He worries mm-hmm. about his kids and stuff, but he doesn't get into the business side of stuff. He doesn't get into the stock market. Mm-hmm. What are people going to learn from reading your book?
Well, I think they're going to learn about the things that should matter to them. The book itself is titled Cashless Society 101. And in it, I define the technical definition of cashless society, which is where there's a society that's increasingly using what we call electronic transactions or digital transactions as opposed
crypto?
To cash. Not exclusively crypto. So this refers, if a lot of people now are familiar with PayPal, Venmo, Zelle. So the cashless movement, I argue, is already happening. Your bank, the local bank branch office next to where I live is just sent me a letter saying they're closing down and they're going to move fully digital. So I can deposit my check from my phone. I can check my balance on my phone. So this is happening, and so it's beyond just crypto. It's saying even banks and services, if you think about governments and filing your taxes, a lot of that is going to be done online, especially because of COVID. So cashless then, from a technical point of view, just means we are doing things digitally or electronically. And I have a second definition, which maybe a lot more people could relate to, which is, what does it mean if you take the cash out of the equation? Can we still exchange? Can we still create value within companies? So it's beyond just the cash and the business, but I argue that it comes back to what we care about as human beings, and you know, themes like trust, identity, ownership. I think we all care who owns the house or owns the car. Mm. And those are some of the questions that I bring up as well.
Now, Brian, so when you're talking cashless, now mm-hmm. let me ask you this, okay?
Sure.
You know, a lot of people, you got to remember, I'm a Gen Xer. How old of a man are you, Brian?
33.
You're 33. Okay, 34. So I'm a Gen Xer. I was the last year of being Generation X, and then you had the millennials. So you would be a millennial, correct?
I mean, a millennial.
All right. So, you know, like my generation, we were one of the first ones that got like use of computers and technology and stuff. You know, we were one of the first ones, and then we kind of grew into it. And then, you know, the millennials and then the Gen Y and all those people, they don't remember a lifetime without the technology. They don't remember a lifetime without the computers and stuff.
Without the internet. Yeah.
Yeah. But the where I'm going with this, though, so you're sure. talking about banks going cashless and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the older generations, they like to be able to go to the bank. They like to be able to pull out money if they mm-hmm. wanted to. You see what I'm saying? Now,
exactly.
Is this, if we go all digital and we don't use our money and stuff mm-hmm. like that, is the money really there? Because in all reality, the money that we use in our country right now is—it's not backed by anything. It used
right
money. Money right. used to be backed by stuff. Now,
no,
so
it's not.
Yeah, ahead. It's not. So if we're going when it comes to all digital stuff, are we just going to start like making up our own numbers? I mean, What is keeping from outrageous inflation, you know, just instead of having to print, on paper. We're printing digital now. I can see where it would be a good thing, but couldn't this also be a bad thing?
Well, I think you captured the whole point of the book, which is basically saying technology is neutral. We can't judge technology as being good or bad. The internet wasn't good or bad. Some good things have come out of it, the phone, the computer. It's the same thing with digital transactions or digital service delivery. And so let's look at money. And you did make another important point, which was the money today, the fiat. Let's talk about the US.
Yeah, fiat dollar, currency.
The euro. It's backed by the faith we have in it. Okay. If you, the day human beings or Americans say, well, I don't think the dollar is worth anything, I'm going to switch to the euro, it will lose its value. So the government tries hard by making sure you trust in the government, even though a lot of people don't, right?
Yeah, no.
There's some element of value when it means, what there's a, you know, there's an expression, American trust. It does mean something. And it's kind of the reason a lot of people around the world always want to hold the dollar. But that's increasingly becoming difficult. As you know, China is also increasing its global influence among other areas. So the reality is the US dominance is not as strong as it used to be 30, 40 years ago. And at the same time, there's more and more need for technology to be the way we do business. So when you talk about shopping, if you look at the last 2-3 years, a lot of people are shopping online because of COVID. A lot of people are doing online deliveries.
Amazon, DoorDash,
Instacart, you name it. And yes, you can tip them in cash, but the purchase itself was done electronically already. You give them your credit card, you give them your PayPal information, you give them maybe your Venmo. I mean, Venmo is now launching out a service for businesses. So when we say cashless, actually, that's why the definition was very important for me to say prefers, a society that prefers. It does not mean absolute elimination of cash or fiat. I think it will be a long, long time for us to see that. But let's take a hard look in the mirror and say, for people that like to go to the bank, is their money really in the bank?
No, it's not.
I remember in 2008, when we had the market crash, I was a freshman in college in Pennsylvania. I mean, you could go to the bank and even for a small amount, they might tell you, come back tomorrow, because they actually didn't have it. So it's already zeros and numbers on a computer somewhere. That's all we're dealing with.
Now, Brian, let me ask you, I'm glad that you brought that up. In 2008, you know, I was married at the time. I was a business owner, and with the housing bubble, the real estate, the banks writing a bunch of bad loans.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we've already found out that some of these banks are corrupt.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, if we're just dealing in ones and zeros and all that stuff, what's going to keep? Just numbers, you know, on a computer. So what I'm trying to say is, so how can we trust the banks to do the right thing? Like, could they just be saying that they're giving away money and they're really not? I mean, you got to understand,
go ahead.
I mean, is that something that could be a concern?
It is an important concern. So I mentioned that the four themes in the book are identity, which could mean digital identity. As you know, passports and all these identities are becoming digitized. But it can also mean also culture and language, right? And not everybody speaks English, or maybe people in India, they just use Hindi, but they can use Google services, right? Ownership, I talked about it a little bit, and this comes to the heart of the matter. If you own money and you give it to the bank, do you still own that money? And it's a 50-50. It's a yes and a no, because it's insured up to a limit. I think it's about 250,000. It could be higher, obviously, if you have a lot more money, because you can pay for more insurance. But if they lose your money up to 250,000, the government, if a bank loses your money up to $250,000. We're talking cash or fiat.
You can't go for any more. They're protected,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, the federal government can only refund you up to that much. So that's the level of trust that comes with the banking system. The bigger problem you are touching on, though, is like all human beings, banks are also corruptible, vulnerable. And more than anything, they're in the banking business to make money. So they will raise overdraft fees. They will sell you bad loans.
Brian.
Wells Fargo. So that's where the bigger problem comes from.
Brian, that makes me so mad. You want to know what really, really made me mad one time? You know, when I was struggling straight, like I was still in college. I had an internship at a radio station. And, you know, you're living paycheck to paycheck at the time. Exactly. I mean, we've all gone through that. And I was a little bit tight, okay? And I bought a couple of things. And do you realize that they took the most expensive thing out first and then hit me for all the other small charges? So it was almost like they were being predators and exactly. making sure I got overdrafted. And then they hit me for all the other smaller ones for $35 a piece.
A day. And it adds up quick. I've been there. It adds up quick. And, you know, sometimes you got to ask them. And this is what sometimes it comes down to. You're almost sometimes forced to say, hey, can I close my account? Because if you actually close your account, those overdraft fees cannot keep growing. Yeah. So I think that's part of the bigger reasons for, or the arguments for moving to technology, is saying the banks are doing a service. They are the middleman. If you don't need the middleman, then you don't have that cost.
Couldn't we be our own banks, Brian?
The answer is yes, and we already are on banks for smaller amounts. So somebody that gets their paycheck, you know, like Square, which is a Cash App, Square launched this app, Cash App or PayPal. A lot of these apps now are coming with routing virtual banking numbers. You can route your paycheck there.
My PayPal has a routing number and a bank account number, and I was getting my. But let me ask you, though, does PayPal have their own bank, or do they, like, I don't know, how does that work?
It's a slippery slope, because the government wouldn't, I wouldn't say we will ever see a world without some kind of government or some kind of regulation, because obviously we got to pay our taxes. So the government is only interested in being able to trace the money beyond a certain limit. The current limit, according to the Biden administration, they're saying it used to be like if you're sending money, like if, you know, I'm originally from Africa, so sometimes I send money abroad. If you're doing international transfer, money transfer, if you ever sent like a money order through a post office or something, anything less than $9,999, so less than $10,000, they didn't have to flag it or report it.
Was that after September 11th, though?
Right. That was after 9/11, 2001. I think. So now, as of this year, I think the policy came out last fall saying anything over $600 in a Venmo, PayPal, now has to be reported to the IRS, which is not a good thing, but it also means the government is beginning to realize a lot more money is moving electronically rather than through cash. Like the casinos were illegal until they were legalized, I do think the cashless society will just be legalized in the sense that the government wants to provide some kind of structure so people don't get scammed.
No, I mean, that's the whole thing. I mean, look at all the things that were illegal, but the government knew that they weren't able to tax it. So they actually made it legal so they could start taxing it. I mean, alcohol used to prohibition. They changed that. Marijuana now, like for example, marijuana, cannabis use in the United States. The government saw that they can make money off of the taxes off of that. So, but Brian, one of my other questions. So it's a two-part question. If we went to an all digital like system when it comes to finances, would that be a global currency? And number two, what about some of you said you're from Africa? There are a lot of poor countries in Africa that maybe don't have access to computers or technology and stuff like that. is that going to pit some of the third world countries even further behind?
The short answer, I'll start with the last question. The short answer is no. Actually, it's, and that's part of the reason, you know, the way I argue for some of these things in the book is it depends on how we design the systems, right? So the largest mobile money transaction ecosystem in the world is in Nairobi, Kenya, in East Africa.
Really? I did not know that.
Yeah, they all only use SMS, so text message, to send the money. Because it's zeros and ones, you don't need a fancy app to say, hey, I just sent you 500.
So it's just binary code.
It's just binary. It's just a simple text. And then you just record it. You're keeping a ledger somewhere. So the recipient, actually, a lot of Kosovo, I think up to only like 20 to 30% smartphone penetration in Africa. So majority are still using the old feature phones, you know, the ones where you used to just text and wait for a response and things like that. So it can actually work without a lot of technology. And even in the US or Western markets, if you think about you, let's say like my grandma or like older people that, you know, are not really comfortable with a lot of smart apps, or they're more
likely to
be frauded. You know, they might think they want $1 million when it's really a scam. We want to limit the fanciness of the technology, make it more practical. So I think if we look at Africa and Asia, where, by the way, this is already a norm in China, Japan, you're basically just shopping with the QR code. You go to a restaurant, you order your sushi or whatever you're ordering, hamburger with a QR code.
You know, could you ever see people getting tattooed with their QR codes to be able to pay for stuff? Or
I see that being the next thing, you know. But in New York, for example, we're already paying for our subway with our phones. So you can just tap your phone and pay your metro subway fee. And I think that's just, again, the subway is the large public institution. It means the city is going to roll this out into other service delivery models, whether it's paying your electric bill. We're going to see more and more of this. But let's go back to the other question, the first part that you had asked. Does the US dollar continue to be competitive if it's digitized? So the conversation around creating federal digital dollars, China already beat the US to that. I think China now launched its own digital currency, the digital yuan, as of last year, and also effectively banned crypto in China. The short answer is there will no longer be a single dominant currency. And part of the reason is because, as I just mentioned, local economies, even like those in Africa, can just set up their own little network and just trade with each other before they even go international. So because, again, the cost of converting becomes lower because, you know, you don't have to wait for 5 days for a bank to approve your $10,000 transaction. So I think when we remove that cost, you know, do you have a phone? Do I have a phone? Let's do business. Yeah. It's going to put pressure on the governments to want to attract your business. And that will just make it easier for other countries to get into the space.
Brian, I just had a funny thought, though. With all this technology, you know, I'm not poor right now. I'm doing well. But I remember back in the day before all the banks and everything was a lot more fast. You remember, you might be too young, but do you remember people used to float checks back in the day? You were talking about that where, like, you know, like you got paid on Friday, but you didn't get it in by a certain time. So the money won't be in there until Monday morning, but I already wrote the check on Friday. So, you know, like, I mean, that's going to mess up a lot of people's little scheme there. I don't even know if you could call it a scheme, but I mean, back in the day, people always would float checks.
Oh, I had a friend in college that would even with cash, you could still do it today, where like some banks have like 24 hours to reconcile the accounts. So you could withdraw like a large balance from your account, and they won't notice until tomorrow. So you always have that 24-hour window to put the money back in.
Hey,
say you really needed it. So it wouldn't necessarily mess up a scheme. There might be a way for a bank, a digital bank, or let's call it telecom companies like the Verizon, get into banking, they might say, look, we know you, we trust you. And this is another thing that I'm glad you brought that up. Let's tie it together with the credit scores conversation. The existing credit scores don't serve any purpose because they were historically biased. They were limited. Not everybody actually, if you think people like us who first come as immigrants and then you kind of already at a disadvantage and you have to start because it's, you know, it's calculated based, I guess, on the length of your history.
It is biased.
So a lot of banks are rolling out their own credit scores and a lot of digital services are coming up and saying, wait a minute, if somebody is paying their rent on time, if somebody is going to school and is paying their student loan on time, why can't we use that information? Or your bank knows how much you're spending because you're ordering Uber every week or you're ordering
your Instacart.
Yeah. They can see you have money and you're spending it.
But you're smart with it.
Yeah, they might actually offer you a better deal rather than relying on a credit score that is updated monthly when actually the information of you spending is happening daily or weekly. So I think there's another change there happening and a lot of banks are already signaling that they want to start using their own information rather than license the external credit reporting bureaus.
Hey, Brian, I know this is probably going to sound, I found this conversation very fascinating because, you know, a lot of people don't want to talk about when it comes to finances and stuff
it's
like
a difficult
that.
Conversation. Yeah,
it is. It really is. You know, a lot of people wish that we just went back to the good old days where we just traded goods and services with each other. It was a lot more simple time.
I'll give you a cow. You'll give me your blanket or something.
Yeah,
you know, there's value in that.
Yeah, I will give you one of my sisters and I get, a hog or a swine, you know, whatever it may be. I'm making bad jokes here, but I know this is going to sound weird. You know, Elon Musk talks about, you know, or one of our greatest threats as humans is artificial intelligence. OK, now, robots, artificial intelligence have no use for money because they really don't need it. But like, say if it like straight up becomes like a Terminator movie and all the computers become self-aware and they just wipe our money right off the face of the earth, like everybody goes down to zero and the robots are like, ha ha ha, you can't now, buy or eat anything. We can now starve you to death. I know that probably sounds stupid, but like,
no, I mean it's the
is that a concern?
And It is a concern, but I like to say that the technology we have doesn't really sort of make it easy to get to that scenario. And the reason is, part of the reason, I think I woke up today reading an article, you know, people post a lot of things on Facebook, the IMF, International Monetary Fund, telling El Salvadorian government to stop using Bitcoin as, because, you know, El Salvador as a government is trying to use more digital or payments rather than relying on fiat from the IMF, which, by the way, IMF has the worst record of trying to help any government improve its financial budgeting. And so the traditional institutions definitely feel threatened by these more digital options. But it does not mean that they are bound to fail, because the key word here is decentralization. Decentralized basically means not one person is in charge. The central bank is the, you know, it's what prints money, or the Federal Reserve, by extension, the central bank.
Oh, we've been doing that. We've been doing a lot of that here in America. Oh my God.
So the advantage is that in the future, as we just discussed, Russia could have its own digital way of doing business. People in Africa are already doing business electronically. So it stops being a matter of who's the big boss in the middle. It just becomes, do you want to do business or not, right?
You want to be independent.
It makes it a little bit easier. And the risk of, who cares if, no offense, if the digital US dollar system goes down and it crashes, people can just switch to another system. So actually it adds like a backup system where, as you know, sometimes another example I like to give in the book, it's like for people who love cash, you know, pray you don't live in an inflationary or some kind of inflationary period or recession, or even recession. In Zimbabwe, you have to carry a wheelbarrow just to buy a loaf of bread.
Oh, because so, you got to carry so much money?
So much cash. Yeah, hey. Or so many coins. So there's already a cost that's also physical and security-wise. You talked about checks. What happens when it rains and the check is ruined? You know, people used to buy traveler checks when they were traveling. So you could argue traveler checks were kind of a system of tracking the money, so you don't have to carry it with you when you go to another country. And when you get there, you give them these traveler checks that you can then cash and exchange. So the key word is value exchange. Do we want to trade? Do we want to do value exchange? Then, yeah, we don't need cash or fiat to do it. It can happen in so many ways.
I remember when my mom and dad got their first debit card.
Yeah,
it was just like, what? I can pay. I don't have to go to the bank and get money. What? I can pay with it. Yeah, it took a lot of time. Now they use it all the time. Now,
yeah.
Another question I have, though, but what about if they do get away and they go to a cashless system? What about the black markets and stuff? Like, for example, how can I? And I'm not trying to, be shocking or something, but say I wanted to go pick up a hooker or something, or I wanted to buy drugs. How do I buy drugs with my digital currency? You know, I know they do it with crypto and stuff like that, but isn't it just making it easy for the government to track what you do with your money?
Yes and no. It's actually easier to track cash than it is to track digital.
I've watched the Ozark. I know how to launder money. So, I know how to launder money. No, I'm messing with you.
You know, the funny thing is, like, I watch a lot of crime shows too. But the funny thing is, especially for American crime films, that have to do with robbing a bank, they always get caught at the end. And I assume the FBI has somebody in Hollywood telling them, yeah, don't let them get away with it. Because, that would encourage more people to rob a bank. So,
they never tell you how much bank robberies actually get either. Have you ever noticed that when they get away, they don't tell you. It was a certain amount. Yeah. They don't tell you. It could have been like for a million.
Yeah. Something could have happened. Thank God we caught them. But I think the argument of tracking is more about trust. Like we say, we trust the fiat currency, even though there's no gold backing it. It used to be gold backed, but it's no longer.
I still got silver certificate bills that are backed by silver.
Nice. That's a good one to have. But you can do that digitally too. So with smart contracts and all these other things, it's like we can have those digital certificates now to say, which is what the stable coins are. Stable coins are basically digital currencies backed by some sort of fiat currency or pegged to some kind of fiat currency. So USDT is probably backed or pegged to the US dollar. The challenge, though, is the trust one. Because again, when regulators go and say, can you show us the $1 million or $1 billion you say is backing this digital currency? They can't find it in the bank, even though the bank documents say that money exists, right? So I'm saying that there's something called trustless now. That's saying, you know what? I don't trust you. You don't trust me. How can we still do business? And that's part of the innovation that's happening to say, maybe I don't have to fully trust you as long as I get my money.
Yeah, no.
As I get it in 5 seconds and not wait for 5 days for the check to clear when it may or may not clear, because checks used to bounce. So I think that's part of the advantage of you actually get your money right now rather than increasing the anxiety of like, oh my God, will this check clear or not? Right. So there is that advantage too.
Brian, I gotta wrap it up, but I do have one more question for you though. Okay. Mm-hmm. So with if we did go to a complete cashless system where it was all digital and stuff, our country, here in the United States, a lot of people hate they disagree with the illegal immigrant workforce that we have in our country, but I would love for people to do it in a certain way, but also at the same time that if it wasn't for illegal immigrants coming here and working, a lot of our produce, a lot of our stuff would die out in the field. There's a lot of jobs that Americans don't want to do. And there's a lot of people that pay immigrants to work the fields and stuff like that, or do menial jobs and stuff. And if it went to a cashless thing, how have you thought about or talked about in your book, like how that would affect that group of people that are here in the United States?
Yeah, well, I think it actually benefits everybody, as I mentioned before. Let's talk specifically, like I said, the current guidance is saying anything over $600 has to be reported to the IRS. Do you really think the average person makes like $600 a day? So even if you're paid daily $600 earning, say, $200,000 by the
end. So you would have to spread it out.
At a minimum, like nobody's working the farm earning that much money. So it's still practical. And I like to argue that the US government isn't stupid either. Sometimes they know these things are going on and they let them go on for the very reasons you just said. Because, you know, they have to secure a food supply for the people. But also, I would like to address one misconception people have about immigrants, which is that...
I'm not saying anything. I'm not saying anything bad.
that immigrants are actually some of the most educated demographic in the U.S. And sometimes they are doing the very jobs that Americans didn't know how to do. I mean, you look at Chobani. I write a story about the Chobani yogurt company with this Greek immigrant.
Oh, that's a great ass. I love that.
And then went on to give the employees ownership of the company. So these kind of technologies actually can allow, if we're looking at immigrants or other communities that may not be historically financially advantaged, to say, hey, we may not have much, but how do we put our talent, you know, to work, to create value so that when it finally pays off, there's already a smart contract or some kind of electronic agreement that allows us to benefit without involving a lot of fancy lawyers, because not all of us can afford fancy lawyers. And I think that's actually the opportunity. So you're seeing a lot of artists trying to say, hey, NFTs or non-fungible tokens. They're basically
that could be
saying,
a currency, couldn't it? NFTs could become a currency. I mean, they're kind of are a currency, aren't they? NFTs?
Yeah, it's kind of a way to then say, to process royalties. Imagine you and I made a song. We don't know each other. We've never met. But all we do is sign on a phone some kind of document that says, if our song makes it, today may not be successful, but the day it gets bought, every time it gets played or something, we get 10 cents. I get 5 cents. You get five cents. We can sign that right now.
Compound interest.
And then we don't have to worry about you screwing me over, which you might once you see that it's worth $1 billion from today. So I think that's the advantage, that you can lock in things because it's hard to delete them if they're on the blockchain. And I think that's what worries a lot of people, because a lot of people want to scam us out of our money, including banks. And that's why the only reason they'll be worried. But it's no different from you giving your neighbor a pie because you baked it yourself and you didn't have to ask them for cash. You just gave them value.
Well, Brian, I highly enjoyed this conversation. Hopefully you did as well, too. Before I let you go, tell my audience once again how they can find out all the info on you and be able to find your books.
So thanks for listening in, everybody. I'm Brian Asinger. You can follow me online at www.brianasinger.com. That's BRIANASINGIA. And the social media handle is the same, at Brian Asinger.
And that's the show for today. Thanks for listening to the Tuttle Daily Podcast. Hey, don't be a dickhead. Do us a favor. Like, share, and subscribe to the show. Also, check out the Tuttle category at 315live.com. The Tuttle Daily Podcast is brought to you by Starfire Transport, StitchYouUp.com, and PocketPairClub.com. Special thanks to show producer Vulture and co-host Siroc. Show voiceover service is brought to you by jcvoiceover.com and The Little Cheese Show. Download and subscribe to The Little Cheese Show everywhere podcasts are found. If you want to help support the show, go to paypal.me/TuttleOnTheRadio. You have something you want to say? Tuttle@gmail.com or leave a voicemail at 407-270-3663. 3044. To follow all Tuttle's social media, go to Tuttle.net. That's Tuttle with two D's .net. Thanks again for all your support, and we'll see you tomorrow on the Tuttle Daily Podcast.
I get ignorant in normal situations.
What? What you mean?
What the fuck you mean?
What are you talking about?
Nigga, what the fuck is you talking about?
Oh, shit.